So you see that the title of the talk is not exactly as in the program, but I'll argue why. Before I start out with the talk, I'd like to make a very brief advertisement of a workshop this September in Ensenada, which is probably of interest to many of you, and because the program is going to be overlapping pretty much, and the website for registration is just being established, so if you're interested in this, go ahead and have a look, or just write an email to Guillermo Garcia Segura, who is the main organizer, or talk to one of the many SOC people who are actually here at this meeting. I would like to discuss progenitors of gamma ray bursts, and the environment is what interests most of you here, but the environment can only be understood from the progenitors. And I would also like to address the distribution of the gamma ray burst progenitors in the universe. And this is the people who contributed to what I say today. At first, I would like to mention a few words about stellar interior physics, which is probably not at the core business of most of you. It's a plea for considering magnetic fields in the evolution of the stellar interior of stars. The reason is the following. Magnetic fields are like rubber bands, and if we have a differentially rotating star, say the core rotates more rapidly than the envelope, then these rubber bands will exert a torque such that angular momentum is transported from the core to the envelope. So if we don't include magnetic fields in our stellar models, we end up with rapidly rotating stellar cores at the end. If we do include magnetic fields, we get much slower rotating cores. Now, why do we need magnetic fields? The reason is that otherwise we get just two rapidly rotating neutron stars. We get two rapidly rotating white dwarfs, which is all demonstrated in the literature. And we get probably, with this kind of angular momenta, the collapse of each individual massive star would be dominated by the rotation process, which I don't think is evidence for. So I think we need magnetic fields in the stellar models. The question which comes up from this, how do we then ever get something like a collapsar? Because on a collapsar, we want to have a star which dies with this type of specific angular momentum to form a black hole. It turns out the idea how to obtain that is relatively old. It's in the literature since more than 20 years. André Meder has come up with it, but never related it actually to gamma ray bursts. And the idea is that you just spin up the star so rapidly in the beginning of its life that internal mixing processes never allow for the build-up of a chemical gradient inside the star. If we have, so this is a Kippenhahn-type diagram with a logarithmic time axis stretching towards the end of the evolution. If we have a rapidly rotating star, then in the radiative envelope of the star, we trigger mixing processes. And if these mixing processes, adding speed circulations basically, if these mixing processes are fast enough, then the star will never have any chemical gradient. And this is a kind of example model which shows this type of evolution. It's a 40 solar mass star at a metallicity of 10 to the minus 5, so it's extremely low metallicity here, which is almost evolving chemically homogeneously due to its initial rapid rotation. This has been published last year, and Woosley and Heger have models of similar nature just being published later this year in APJ. So these rapidly rotating stars are almost chemically homogeneous, and the reason that in this situation the core does not slow down is the star actually never has any extended envelope. So our rubber bands cannot transport angular momentum out because there's nothing rotating at slow angular velocity there, which is massive. Now, we have to go to low metallicity in order to avoid the spin down of the star by its own wind. It's known that if stars have especially Wolf Rayet stars, if they have a strong wind, then they lose angular momentum and they slow down their rotation. To avoid that, we need to retreat to low metallicity, because we know that the winds of massive stars, also of Wolf Rayet stars, become weaker at low metallicity. So for a very low metallicity, we have computed a grid of such models, and in the initial mass, initial rotation rate plane, so this is measuring the initial rotation rate of the star in terms of its critical rotation, we see a division which looks as follows. Above this curved line here, we get the phenomenon of homogeneous, quasi-homogeneous chemical evolution. And so all these stars mix in the hydrogen rather than losing it in the wind. And so they keep all the angular momentum. And so all these models retain angular momentum in their cores, which are sufficient within the collapsar model, despite the presence of the magnetic fields in the stellar evolution models. Below this line, you get the normal kind of evolution where you form supergiants. You slow down the core through the magnetic fields. And so this is the evolution you're all familiar with. If we look at this unfamiliar part of this diagram, I want to stress that really the evolution is quite different. For example, notice that we get black holes out of 10 solar mass stars, simply because there's very little mass loss, and the whole star is transformed into a metal core. However, in this case, there is some envelope building up because mixing efficiencies get weaker for lower mass, and so these guys don't rotate quickly enough anymore to form a collapsar. If we go to lower metallicity, what happens is that the stellar winds become more important and slow down the stars. And in this case, it's the Wolf-Rayet wind which becomes stronger. And so this window where we can actually have enough angular momentum in the core is closing down. If we go to, this is 10 to the minus 3. If we go to still higher metallicity, then this curved line starts moving up because the wind mass loss on the main sequence in the O star phase becomes so important that chemical homogeneous evolution does not occur anymore. So in the galaxy, we will not find this type of evolution, at least not throughout the evolution of the star. May start initially like that, but will soon slow down. Okay, so we have these grids of models at various metallicities, and what we've wondered is, well, we know there aren't so many low metallicity stars around. Can we actually get enough gamma ray bursts from such kind of model? And what we've done is we've looked at the latest derivation of rotational velocities of O stars at low metallicity. This is done here for the only star cluster which is accessible to us, which has a relatively low metallicity. That's the NGC 346 in the SMC, so it has roughly a fifth of solar metallicity. It's only one cluster where you can actually do this kind of thing. So we've taken fits to the distribution of rotational velocities, and what you see is that the observed velocities go to roughly 0.4 or 0.5 of the critical rotation rate. So if we compare that again here, we're talking about a cutoff in this part of the diagram. And so the most relevant progenitors from this type of model will be in this part of the diagram. So if one convolves this with an initial mass function, one can derive a fraction of gamma ray bursts to supernova expected from such kind of model as function of the metallicity. And you see that generally it's of the order of a few percent or so of all massive stars which go this path, and there is a metallicity cutoff roughly a little higher than a 10th solar metallicity for the particular parameters which go into this model. one wonders then how many stars of low metallicity do we have. And with Colin Norman we made a model of the metallicity evolution of the universe, and if one looks, it's basically based on empirical determinations of metallicities and masses of galaxies locally but also at high redshift. And so if this is a particular star formation rate as function of redshift, then we find that low metallicity massive stars follow rather this curve. So at high redshift, of course, they both merge because all stars have low metallicity there. But locally, stars with a metallicity less than, say, a tenth solar are rare by a factor of roughly 100. Now, why is that important to know? Let's assume there's a metallicity bias in observed gamma ray bursts. Let's make a strong case and say we have a bias of really a tenth solar. So most bursts come from metallicity of less than a tenth solar. Now, many people believe that locally the gamma ray burst to supernova ratio is roughly 1 to 1,000. All these numbers can be played with, but let's just take those as an example. Now, if we have only 1 in 100 massive stars having metallicity less than a tenth solar, and also we have to consider that out of all supernovae we cannot make black holes, but maybe only out of 1 of 20 because the IMF, then we see that we have to assume every black hole makes a gamma ray burst with these kind of numbers. And so a metallicity bias in the long gamma ray burst would imply that it's very difficult, for example, for binary scenarios to come up with a sufficient number of progenitor stars. We can calculate the redshift distribution of the gamma ray bursts compared with the supernova distribution. Of course, we find more bursts at high redshift. We can, in this model, compare the gamma ray burst to supernova ratio as function of redshift as well. And you see this model ends up with a little less than 1,000 locally, but increases to of the order of, well, here we end up at this 5% value, which is motivated by the metallicity. There's another way to look at the metallicity of gamma ray burst progenitors, and this is looking at the circumstellar bubbles which they drive. We've been hearing that there is evidence for a constant density medium around gamma ray burst progenitors, and so we have been wondering how this could be achieved doing simulations of circumstellar medium around these stars. We've already heard a couple of times that if we take the normal conditions in our galaxy, we get the constant density medium, so the radius of the wind termination shock at 10 parsecs or later. Now, which ways would one have to get the wind termination shock closer? This is a simulation by Alain van Marle, where he assumed that the Wolf-Rayet star, and actually the previous supergiant as well, is a runaway object which moves through the interstellar medium with a velocity of 50 kilometers per second. And you see that, of course, then you get a bow shock, and you do get the termination shock closer into values of the order as they are needed. Now, this may be a possibility, but it's perhaps not very likely that all gamma ray bursts come from runaway stars. One can also wonder how big should, or how strong should we vary quantities like the wind velocity of the Wolf-Rayet progenitor, or the mass loss rate of the progenitor star, or the interstellar medium density, which if it's high also gives rise to a large pressure around the Wolf-Rayet star. And this is in the three-dimensional space, color coding of where the wind termination shock would be located in parsecs, logarithm of parsecs. So what we need is this very dark part that what referred by the previous talks. And so we would have to retreat to very extreme values of all three quantities at the same time to obtain that. Now the argument which I think one can perhaps try is whether things are not really much easier if we go to low metallicity. Because at low metallicity we do have low mass loss rates, so we are at the back of the wall here basically. And also, about the wind velocities, we don't know very much, but perhaps there's a dependence on the wind velocity too. And so finding a lot of these constant density circumstellar medium slopes may imply, again, something about the metallicity. And what Aladjanich actually tried out, and I want to show this here, is to locate the density structure in a plane where we have redshift here of the gamma ray burst and the isotropic energy of the burst on the y-axis. Now what you see in color coding is constant density medium implied by the red hexagons and wind interstellar medium implied by the blue squares. The triangles are ambiguous. And the size of the symbol tells you whether more than one group agreed on the same result or not. So the big symbol indicates that there was a general agreement. There was no ambiguity. Now, we've learned earlier in the talks today, and I have not put that in, that there's much more cases now where we have actually constant density or indications for constant density environment. But I'd be curious to see where they would end up in this plane here. The idea that if we go to high redshift is, of course, that we more easily encounter low metallicity stars. And so then we can more easily explain this. And again, for higher energy, for higher isotropic energy, the burst would be more relativistic for the same mass loading, and it would come further out before we actually get the chance to observe it. So it would go to larger radius for a given point in time. So I think we have single star models for gamma ray burst progenitors now, which make a couple of predictions which are worth testing. The independent argument is that if indeed we get an observational low metallicity bias for gamma ray bursts, then we have single stars dominating, and that's not depending on the particular scenario I showed you, that's just counting how many cases we can have. And we have a large number of high gamma ray burst, high redshift gamma ray burst predicted by this model, and it would be interesting to find ways to test this. And the afterglow and the shock wind may also be an indication that we're actually dealing with low metallicity stars, so low metallicity and also rapidly rotating, that actually looking around in the galaxy on the local vicinity for comparable cases doesn't make sense, because we will never find them. So the structure around the gamma ray burst host stars indeed may be different from what we expect by just analyzing our local environment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Norbert. Question?
Can you tell me what observational evidence is there linking GRBs to low metallicity?
There have been metallicity determinations through various ways. So what you see here is metallicity and redshift. The contours are what our cosmic metallicity model would give you for an unbiased population, so for stars of all metallicities, in terms of supernova rate. The green dots are metallicity determinations from afterglows. The stars here are metallicity determinations from the host galaxies. And Philip pointed out that paper by Gorosabel et al., which adds actually points around here at very low redshift, and I think it has also two high metallicity points. Now, this diagram has to be looked at a little bit careful, because the supernova rate goes down a lot, and what you don't see is that actually in the local universe you would expect most supernova to occur, of course, at a metallicity of roughly solar. And so it is controversial how to interpret these results. Our metallicity cutoff is down here. So you would say, there's many cases which contradict it, which is, interesting for us to learn. But I think the observational results still have to be interpreted and are also not converged to the very certainty level.
other questions, remarks? If not, then let us thank Robert again. Let us thank all the other speakers of this morning. The afternoon is